In understanding by design in stage one, we have different categories that people should think about when they're thinking about learning goals or desired results. There's discrete knowledge of factual information and basic concepts. There are skills, including very basic skills. There are conceptual understandings, which are larger and more abstract. And then we've identified what we call long-term transfer goals. And one of the things we found is using those categories can help teachers or curriculum teams really unpack standards. Because as you know, standards are often an unhelpful mix of different goal types, but you have to ferret them out. You know, some standards in some subjects like history or science may have lots of declarative knowledge, kind of facts. But every subject has processes or practices, but they're placed in different places in the standards.
I'm Jim Knight, co-founder of the Instructional Coaching Group, and you're listening to Coaching Conversations, where I talk with coaching experts from around the world so that all of us can learn better ways to make an unmistakably positive impact on the people around us.
Hello, listeners. It's ICG consultant Jessica Wise, and I want to invite you to join Jim Knight and the Instructional Coaching Group team at this year's Teaching, Learning, Coaching Conference in New Orleans. If you are looking to learn, practice, reflect, and grow your craft, the TLC conference is the place to be. Whether you join us in person or online, you'll experience meaningful keynotes, powerful breakouts, and time to network and invest in human connection with like-minded educators. Join us October 27th through the 29th as we gather to empower passionate educators to keep kids first. Visit instructionalcoaching.com/TLC-2024. I hope to see you there.
Jay, it's great to see you. I am always grateful for the chance to have conversations ever since we met a long time ago on a running path in Melbourne, Australia. So since then, it's been kind of legendary, our friendship. So it's great to see you.
Well, likewise, Jim. Appreciate the opportunity.
Your work has, I think when people think about curriculum design, the first thing they would think about would be UBD or understanding by design. It gets like shaped the way so many people see curriculum. So I'm grateful for the time to talk about what you've been doing and what it looks like.
Well, I'm happy to oblige.
Well, good. And I must say, I work with a lot of different educational consultants like you do and meet people all the time. You're one of the most personable people I work with. You always hang around and make time to meet people and talk with people. You don't just show up and leave and do your thing. So I'm grateful for the chances we've had to talk to.
Well, likewise.
So my first question is just, how did you come, what led you to focus on the concept of understanding by design or UBD?
Well, understanding by design is really the product of the confluence of two careers coming together at an opportune time, myself and my colleague, Grant Wiggins. I'll give you a short story of how we met because it leads into this question. I was working at the Maryland Department of Education in the late 80s and early 90s. And when the standards movement hit around the country, really stimulated by the governor's education policy summit in Charlottesville, Virginia, back in the day when Bill Clinton was head of the Governors Association, that meeting was the launch for the first generation of standards in this country. I was at the Maryland Department of Ed, and like every state, we were tasked with coming up with state standards and measures of student learning of those standards. So that was the first generation of standards development. I was on the team that was responsible for leading the standards development. But in the assessment arena, we decided to be bold, and we wanted to break out of the typical multiple choice, low-level testing. And so Maryland was working to develop statewide performance-based assessments. It was in that context that I met Grant Wiggins. Grant at the time was working with the Coalition of Essential Schools under Ted Sizer's leadership, and he was popularizing the notion of, quote, authentic assessment. So we brought Grant in as a consultant to us. And interestingly, I met him. We were the same age. He went to St. John's College, which is in Annapolis, Maryland, near me. And we just hit it off. We were simpatico. that was how we met. So fast forward a couple of years later, I was starting to do workshops on performance-based assessment, as was Grant, and we were at a couple of conferences together. And at one ASCD conference, a mutual friend invited us to dinner, and we got to dinner, and she said, you know, there's no free dinner. We're here to make a proposal to you. We want the two of you to write a book together and promise me that you'll meet and get back to me in a week with your outline. So the next morning, Grant and I met and said, I said, what do you think? He said, well, I'd be happy to write a book with you, but I don't want it to just be on assessment, which is what they thought it would be. Grant said, my doctoral work at Harvard was on curriculum. And I said, I don't want it to be on assessment solely either. My interest is in what I would call cognitive process instruction, thinking skills, and integrating students in more of a constructivist view of learning. So it was literally at that breakfast table that the conception of Understanding by Design was born. Here's a summary. Since its early inception, Understanding by Design framework has prioritized teaching and assessing for understanding of important transferable ideas and processes, ultimately to prepare students to be able to transfer their learning, to be able to apply their learning effectively, not just give it back in a rote way, but to actually use their learning to navigate new things. And the by design part is simply a, quote, backward design model for planning curriculum, assessment, and instruction with those ends in mind.
But you chose the word design really carefully, though, because you see it as not just knocking out the curriculum, but actually using some of the principles of design to put it together. Is that true?
That is correct. And, you know, backward design is not a new idea. You know, Ralph Tyler wrote about it in his Principles of Curriculum book, but we both agreed that it was a powerful idea and one that wasn't always followed, whether it's teachers planning units and lessons or curriculum teams planning. The essence of backward design, it's not a new idea, of course. Ralph Tyler talked about this in a book in 1949, the year of my birth. But Grant and I have found it to be an effective planning process. And just for the listeners that may not be familiar the way we operationalize it, we propose that when we're planning curriculum or arguably anything, we start with goals, or we call them desired results. But then the second stage of backward design is really the key. We ask people to think like assessors. It's one thing to say, I want students to learn this or understand that. It's another to ask the question, what will show that they really know that or really understand and can apply this? So we ask people to think like assessors before they get too invested in planning their lessons. Traditional teacher lesson planning occurs in stage three. That's where we plan our lessons, decide how much time we're going to spend, what resources we'll use, et cetera. So that's the by design part of UBD. One other element I like to throw in and maybe come back to it in more detail. I think of Understanding by Design as a planning framework now along essentially two tracks. One track is the teacher track. So Understanding by Design is a framework that can help teachers plan, arguably, better units with lessons within. And in many schools, teachers are the primary planners, particularly of lessons. We think UBD is a good framework for teachers. But the second track is what I call the macro track. That's how do you apply a framework to an overall curriculum, pre-K to 12, within and across disciplines. And so the ideas of Understanding by Design and backward design work equally well for both tracks. An analogy that I sometimes use is patchwork quilt. You know, individual teachers can make a little square, and teams maybe will map out the whole year. But the patchwork quilt is the overall pattern into which individual units and curriculum maps will fit. And we want coherence and we want alignment in an overall district or school curriculum. So UBD can play a role in both macro and micro levels.
I want to go deeper into UBD and how it applies to coaching, and I have a bunch of questions, but maybe we could take a minute and talk about Grant Wiggins. I never had the chance of meeting him, but I've heard many stories about what a person he was like. He was your co-author and you worked together. What was it like working with Grant? What kind of person was he?
Grant was one of the smartest persons, people I've ever encountered, extremely thoughtful. I mentioned very briefly, he went to St. John's College. And for listeners who don't know that, that's a small liberal arts college in Annapolis, Maryland. And I think they have a campus in Santa Fe. But what's unique about it, the entire curriculum is built around Socratic seminars studying great books.
Hmm.
And that explained a lot about Grant, because he himself was very Socratic. Sometimes when you came to him with a problem or a challenge, he would come back with a question. So he was A, very smart, a good questioner. He had very strong ideas. But what I loved about him was, and I learned this early on, when we were talking about ideas and we were working on co-writing, he could put his ego aside, and he liked to argue, but he was not an intellectual bully. He wanted you to push back, because we both understood or came to understand that our ideas get better when we push and fight mm-hmm. and debate. But it wasn't about who's right. It was about what are the best ideas and bringing clarity to our work. So I admired him greatly. Grant was more aggressive, if you will. And I remember being in presentations with him where he would sometimes get into almost shouting matches, because he would make statements that would upset the status quo. And I was more the diplomat. So that was one part of our relationship. An analogy I like to use was, Grant is a heat seeker. He was always pushing the envelope, always wanted to try new things, got bored quickly. I was a stone polisher. I was trying to make his ideas crisp and clear and practical. And so we made a great, you know, partnership because of that sort of yin and yang.
Hi, everyone. It's ICG consultant Jessica Wise, host of the Coaching Questions on the Coaching Conversations podcast with Jim Knight. Are you interested in learning about tools and resources to build and maintain a successful instructional coaching program? If so, join our Instructional Coaching Institute, designed for instructional coaches and administrators. In this 16-week course led by Jim Knight, you'll learn how to establish a proven foundation for success, develop a deeper and complete understanding of the coaching process and practices, and cultivate necessary communication skills for healthy conversations. We will also explore engagement in the classroom and coaching tools and resources. Learn more by visiting instructionalcoaching.com. I look forward to seeing you at the Institute.
Well, we lost him way too soon. It was a shock to hear it. And I can imagine how hard it must have been for you. He was such a force in education, much like yourself. The two of you together have changed the nature of how we see instruction, without question. How would you describe his influence on you? How did he influence you?
I can sometimes be impulsive, and I learned from him the importance of keeping an open mind, and almost in the Stephen Covey sense, seeking to understand first. Mm-hmm. He's that principle. And one of the ways of doing that is through asking questions. So trying to ferret out what someone else is thinking, or where they're coming from, or what's their perspective, was something I admired in him, and I think it rubbed off on me.
Mm.
The second thing was never being too comfortable with your own status quo. Sometimes I thought he went a little too far. Like he would regularly want to change things. I was always fighting for, let's not throw out the things that work, let's look to refine them. But you were never static or comfortable working with Grant. And I think that stretched me in a good way.
Well, and that leads to the next. So when did the first book come out? Was it like 1997. Okay.
Was the first publication of the first edition of Understanding by Design. And, you know, Grant and I, neither of us are university people, so we weren't in the publish or perish kind of mindset. I had a full-time job, and Grant had fairly recently started a consulting firm. But we wrote the book because we thought we had ideas that we felt had merit, and ASCD gave us the opportunity. But literally, Grant and I had no idea that anyone would read the book. And I remember asking him early on, and after it was released, I said, so Grant, what do you expect? What do you expect this will do if anyone reads it? He said, well, if anyone reads it, I'd be happy with a 5 to maybe 7 year run. And then, you know, most things come and go. But for perhaps some identifiable reasons, UBD is still alive and kicking and has been influential.
How has it evolved over time?
The key ideas of understanding by design are unchanged. And those are focus of curriculum instruction assessment around developing and deepening student understanding of important ideas and processes such that they can transfer their learning. That's the core. Secondly, the stages of backward design, whether applied by individual teachers or entire district curriculum process, are unchanged. So understanding by design in its title is fixed. But there has been quite a bit of evolution in a couple of lanes. One is something I think that we have done well and continue to is we have a number of specific what we call design tools for helping people actually work with curriculum, unpack standards, formulate essential questions, generate authentic, rich performance tasks. And so we have a number of books, starting with the UBD handbook, a workbook, and then thirdly, a set of design guides that have a lot of practical tools for bringing this work to life. As a sidebar, I've done a fair amount, as you have, international work, and many international schools are using the International Baccalaureate System. And over the years, we've had many teachers, especially primary years and middle years program, say that not only is those programs compatible with UBD, but the UBD tools help them with their planners.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one. A second arena, interestingly, the standards movement was still in its early stages when Understanding by Design came out. And so we upgraded to help people work with standards. I'll give you a quick example of what that, one of the things that meant. In Understanding by Design in stage one, we have different categories that people should think about when they're thinking about learning goals or desired results. There's discrete knowledge of factual information and basic concepts. There are skills, including very basic skills. There are conceptual understandings, which are larger and more abstract. And then we've identified what we call long-term transfer goals. And one of the things we found is using those categories can help teachers or curriculum teams really unpack standards. Because as you know, standards are often an unhelpful mix of different goal types, but you have to ferret them out. You know, some standards in some subjects like history or science may have lots of declarative knowledge, kind of facts. But every subject has processes or practices, but they're placed in different places in the standards. Transfer goals may not be evident in grade level standards, but they're almost always stated in the opening pages, which many teachers never read. If you want to know why you should be teaching mathematics and what the goals are, go to the opening pages and they'll talk about the long-term goals for a mathematics education. That's a long way of saying UBD can be a filter to help you make sense of standards. And as we know from John Hattie's research and others, teacher clarity about the goals to which they're teaching is a highly significant variable in student learning. And UBD, if anything, promotes goal clarity in stage one.
Yeah, the knowledge skills.
One more part of my answer, and then I'll stop going on.
Mm-hmm.
One of the decided evolutions of UBD was for Grant and I to put more emphasis on transfer as an explicit goal. Another factor that we see around the country in many districts and schools and even internationally is the formulation of what is often known as a portrait of a graduate or profile of a graduate.
Mm-hmm.
The recognition that there are important goals of a modern education that transcend traditional disciplines. And so the schools or districts that have formulated such a portrait typically identify things like critical thinking, innovator, someone who could work with others well cooperatively, maybe global citizen is in the mix. And from a curriculum point of view, if a school or district says we have these profile competencies, well, we need to integrate them into the curriculum along with disciplinary knowledge and skills, and we should do that by design. And UBD has proven to be a very practical and effective framework for actually bringing those competencies into the mix, as opposed to having them just on a poster in the hallway somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Have you moved away from the term enduring understanding?
We use that term, the term enduring, as a modifier to make a point. It has sometimes proven confusing to people, however, so I have kind of backed off from it. But here's the intent. Just as we labeled certain types of questions as essential questions,
mm-hmm.
we use the term enduring to suggest that there are some ideas that really do last, but they need to be taught for understanding so they won't just fade away like superficial knowledge. But the term has sometimes caused confusion when people say, well, what's the difference between a big idea, an understanding, and an enduring understanding? And so I don't want the modifier to cause that confusion.
Right.
But it is useful to say as a question, of all the content you might teach, what's most important and why, and what do you hope will last, that the student will really understand 5, 10, 15 years from now? What do you hope will endure in your teaching is another way of using that phrase.
So a skill could be an enduring understanding. That's where it gets confusing.
Oh, here's an interesting point. When teachers are teaching skills, which are procedural, mm-hmm. right? They describe what you can do. The understanding is beneath that.
Mm-hmm.
So what does this person need to understand to execute this skill well?
Mm-hmm.
And I'll give you a quick example of that from my days as a swimming coach. You could say swimming is a skill-based activity, right? And you teach kids stroke mechanics. But the larger under the water concept is the only thing you want to do with your arms in swimming, in any stroke you're swimming, is always pull and push the maximum amount of water directly backward with maximum force. That's the big idea. And having that idea then helps you explain stroke mechanics. So people often swim breaststroke like this when they're just swimming leisurely. So for people listening, I'm swimming breaststroke, but I'm pushing the water sideways. I'll go forward, but not as fast as if I push the water directly backward.
Mm.
The point is, the big idea is always pull and push water backward. And the skills are the stroke mechanics that enable you to achieve that big idea, hence greater propulsion. With the exception of very, very raw, simple, basic skills, every procedural type of goal, and you think about the big ones, writing, problem solving, research, argumentation, problem solving, there are conceptual understandings that undergird mm-hmm. those processes. And so I like to say a skill or a process is what you want students to do. It's a transfer goal. What are the understandings that will enable someone to use those processes and skills well?
I've always loved the term enduring understanding. That's why I was curious about it. I've used it. I always say, if you meet that student on the street 10 years from now, what do you want her or him to remember? And
yep.
That's for me, the legacy you leave with a kid is your enduring understanding.
I agree. And so I'm adding a wrinkle to that then with transfer goals.
Mm.
What do you want them to be able to do 10 years from now with the content and the skills you've taught them?
Well, the transfer, like if the focus is transfer, then that's going to significantly change your assessment. Because
Absolutely.
If my focus is acquisition, then a multiple choice test might work or a quick check for understanding. But if the goal is transfer, the assessment's got to be pretty significantly different.
Absolutely. And that gets into the logic of backward design and why stage two precedes stage three. Whereas too often, at least I know my own teaching and Grant as well, we used to describe our teaching was have a general idea of goals. We planned activities or we marched through a textbook. And then we'd have a test at the end to get a grade to go in a grade book because we had to have those. And we're saying, no, shift that around. Think like an assessor early rather than later.
Well, that's great. What are some, I'm guessing that there are a lot of common misconceptions about understanding by design. What are a couple of those, and how do you address them?
A big misconception occurs when a school leader, maybe assistant soup or a curriculum director or a principal at the school level, mandates that teachers must use UBD for their unit planning and requires them to complete the we have a template, a planning mm-hmm. template for unit level planning. And when there is such a mandate, without sufficient preparation or professional support, et cetera, teachers tend to see it as just a bunch of boxes to fill in.
Right.
So that's a misconception. Backward design is, if in essence, a way of thinking, a way of prioritizing the content you teach, a way of ensuring that you have appropriate evidence for all your goals, not just the things that are easy to test and grade, and a teaching learning system designed to achieve those goals. People don't have to use the UBD template to use UBD well. It's a way of thinking. The misconception is, oh, I got to fill in boxes and I'm done. People put a lot of stupid things in boxes. Another misconception is more of a yes, but. Particularly in public schools in the U.S. or in Canada, England, Australia, where there are high-stakes standardized accountability tests. The yes, but is, well, Jay, this is all well and good, but we're being held accountable on these standardized tests. They're multiple choice. They don't ask essential questions. They don't have performance assessment tasks. So why should we use UBD? Because we're being held accountable for something very different. Grant and I love to unpack that, and it's a predictable and reasonable concern or response. But we think at the root of it, it is a misconception that the asker has. And as you know, because you've studied these things, people tend to conflate assessment format with cognitive demand. And often the assumption is if it's multiple choice, they must be assessing low-level skills and facts. And so there's no higher order requirements here. They don't ask essential questions. They don't have to do 3-day projects or performance tests. But as you know, Jim, because you study this stuff, the dirty little secret is, in fact, here's a question. What are the most widely missed items on standardized state tests or national tests like NAEP? They are not items of factual recall or basic skills. They are items that on the depth of knowledge scale, they're DOK3. In mathematics, the problems that kids get most incorrect are problems that require reasoning and the application of concepts. They're multi-step, even though there's a, quote, selected response format, it's not low level. Reading items, the highest levels that are most widely missed involve interpretation and inferencing. My therefore is the best test prep is not doing a bunch of low level multiple choice test prep worksheets. The best test prep is giving kids lots of experience applying their learning to something new, transferring it and explaining what they've done and giving them feedback on their ability to apply. That's the best test prep. That's one way of answering your question. The misconception is because we have low-level tests, we don't need UBD. And mm-hmm. my response is, on the contrary, this is going to help you help your students navigate those accountability tests.
Yeah, so I don't want this to sound critical because it's not, but I feel like the kind of thinking you're describing, getting really clear, what John Hattie would call teacher clarity, which for him has, I don't know, 0.75 effect size or something, really powerful. And it does not, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to see. If you really know what you're teaching, it's going to be more helpful. But it seems like in organizations, not just in education, the kind of thinking where you get really clear on what you're going to do is like a level we often don't go to. And when we can take teachers to that level of depth of clarity or guide them or invite them, however you want to put it, when they really get really clear, it's not just a little nice to do. It transforms what happens in the class. Is that what's been your experience?
Yeah, that's very well said, Jim. And that has been my experience. And it underscores a couple of things that I advocate for both schools and districts. And that is, one of the best uses of professional learning time is having opportunities for teachers to work with colleagues to plan out what they're teaching. And I would recommend UBD, give each other feedback, not only from grade level, but cut across subjects, cut across grades, because another set of eyes can really help you. And two heads are better than one. Now with AI tools in the mix, as a friend of mine said, we can think of AI as a really smart friend who can be helpful. But he also had an interesting sidebar. He said, but like, I have a good friend, but sometimes he gets drunk and I don't take him seriously. So that's a long way of saying, I think collaborative curriculum building, collaborative assessment design, and collaborative instructional planning brings teacher clarity and better ideas to the fore. And AI can be a contributor to that collaborative design process.
I know you and Carol Tomlinson, we share a friendship with Carol, but I know you and Carol Tomlinson wrote a book that combined UBD and differentiated instruction. So how does UBD address the needs of diverse learners?
Well, it's a great question in a couple of ways. In stage one of backward design, essential questions can play an inviting role. And this is one of Carol's phrases. She says, we want our teaching to be invitational. We want to invite all kids in, depending, irrespective of their background, their skill level, their grades, et cetera. Essential questions are inherently open questions. And by posing them and literally inviting all kids in, we're just doing that. We're saying, we expect that you can think and you can grapple with this question. Look, the reality is some kids are going to go deeper, faster, et cetera, but we're not going to reserve central questions for the gifted program. We're going to invite everybody in. That's one way. In stage two of backward design, which we haven't talked about too much, but we really nest our primary assessments around performance tasks. And to me, a good performance task is itself open-ended, presenting students with a situation, scenario, context where they have to apply their learning. The open-ended nature of performance tasks also has the opportunity to allow appropriate voice and choice for students while still letting them demonstrate the desired learning that we're after. A related point is, I could go finer grained on this, but we can, in fact, differentiate performance tasks as long as we're clear on the goals we're trying to assess and we agree on the success criteria for them. Between those bookends, if you will, there's opportunities for voice and choice. I've been working with something that I call task frames that are very specific tools that can create structures for assessment tasks while still giving both teacher and student a choice in the mix. A final point I'll make is under the heading of authenticity. When we think about authentic assignments or authentic performance tasks, the general connotation is authentic to the world outside of school, i.e., how do people outside of school use math or apply statistics or apply their knowledge of history? And that's a primary connotation. The second connotation, however, is more kid-oriented. To what extent is our assignment or our task authentic to the interests, experience, and culture of our students? Because those two dimensions of authenticity are not always conjoined. I could give you many examples of tasks that are authentic to the real world, but the kids don't know anything about that context and generally don't care.
Right.
So ideally, you can't always do it, but ideally we want to create tasks and assignments that fuse authentic applications of learning with relevant, culturally supportive conditions that students can relate to.
Now, authenticity is authentic to the student, but ideally authentic to the student, but also, I suppose, authentic to later on in life and using it in different ways as well. Sort of both those things at the same time, ideally.
Ideally. I'll give you a quick example that, that both of us as music lovers were like. I will enjoy it. It was an algebra teacher who was setting up, basically he had a task involving using algebraic formulations, but he gave kids some choice options, one of which was music. And I won't go into all the details of it, but it was the idea of organizing and forecasting CD sales of different genre and using algebraic both notation and data displays. And he told me about two kids that just got really into it. And it was the music doorway that made the difference for them.
Well, that's the deal of music. It is a doorway for lots of things. So a lot of the people listening to this podcast are instructional coaches. What would you say instructional coaches need to know about understanding Bazan?
Well, I'm going to answer it maybe a slightly different way the way you posed it, but one way of answering it is if they know the basics of UBD, the elements that are in each stage of backward design, then one of their most important roles as a coach is a giver of feedback. Mm. And to use many of the wonderful techniques that you teach about how to give feedback and how to be a critical friend without being critical and so on. But more specifically, coaches can help teachers in their planning. Look at their essential questions, because they're hard to write well, and often they're not. So giving them feedback and being a co-constructor with them on essential questions, helping them prioritize from all this potential content to zero in on the big ideas, help them answer the question, what's most enduring in what I'm teaching and why? Secondly, helping them think better as assessors. And by the way, in stage two of backward design, the assessment evidence is essentially evaluative assessment or summative. It's, if these are the learning goals, what will we look at to see the extent to which students have met them? And for teachers who have to give grades, and most do, the grades would be derived from evaluative assessments. Those are different than formative assessments that are part of our instruction and planned in stage three. But here's an example of a coaching move that's really effective, I've found. Let's say a coach is working with either a teacher or a team, and they're planning out a unit using UBD, and they're clear about their goals in stage one. Now they're planning out their assessments in stage two. And here's how this technique works. You ask the teacher or the team to only show you as a coach their planned assessments for a unit, and you tell them what you think their goals are in stage one.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, can I, or maybe you have two teams that match
yeah,
up,
yeah, yeah.
Can I infer only from your assessments what your goals are? Can I predict, here's what you want students to know, here are the skills, here are the conceptual understandings, here are the transfers that you're after? It's a great feedback check, if you will, for backward design, because goal clarity needs to be matched with assessment appropriateness.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, and too often we may have grand, important goals, but we're only assessing a portion of those, the stuff that's easy to test and grade. And that feedback that a coach can give, and it's not a criticism, it's simply, I looked at your assessments, here's what I think you're after. And the teacher's then faced with whether it's a good match or not. And that gets into your head. So next time you're planning your assessments, you're going to be more mindful of the alignment to your goals.
Yeah, if your assessments are effective, I should be able to look at them and say, it looks to me like your goals are these. And
exactly.
If something's missed, then you got to go back and rethink the assessment. And
exactly.
I would say along with that, I'm thinking that to some extent, the coach can see the lesson through the kid's eyes. And they can provide another perspective on what the lesson's teaching.
Absolutely. In fact, especially with assessment, but also with assignments, sometimes the teacher planner is clear in their mind what they're after, but the coach is, particularly if the coach is from a different subject area, they look at the plan and say, just as you noted, if I were a student in your class, I'm not exactly sure what you're asking for here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really helpful feedback, because we can just get too close to our work as teachers.
Yeah. One of my favorite coaching questions is, if you had a friend who was in the situation you're in, what advice would you give them? And it's kind of the same thing. You step back, answer the question, you have to kind of step back from it. Do you have anything else you want to share about how coaches could support implementation of UBD?
Well, certainly in the classroom, and much of what you teach is just so brilliant and powerful, of when coaches have the opportunity to observe, really observe with two eyes, or two lenses, I should say, certainly noting the teacher's moves, but really looking at what the students are doing. And I like to suggest there, broadly speaking, there are three roles for teachers and concomitant roles for students. As we know, there's direct instruction and modeling, and there's a very important place for that. And in that role as a teacher, we can see how effective they are in their direct instruction and modeling. And the student ideally would be observing, taking notes, or, you know, taking that in. Then there's the facilitative role of the teacher, asking open-ended questions, giving advice, but stepping back and letting the student be more of the leader. And the teacher facilitates discussion or gives them probes for problem solving. And again, we can look at both the teacher's effectiveness as a facilitator, and the student has to be more active. Student as worker, teacher as coach, that kind of model from Ted Sizer. And then the third role, in fact, is teacher as coach. And Grant Wiggins used to use a lot of sports analogies. It's like, now you're stepping back and the kids are playing the game. They're doing authentic work, and your job is giving them feedback. And you may drop back in and do some direct instruction and modeling when they're screwing up. But it's the evolution from direct instruction, modeling, facilitating, stepping back, gradual release of responsibility. And the student role then has to be much more autonomous, independent, and playing the game, doing authentic work in that third role. So that's a long way of saying, if you think about it, there are almost six cells. There's the teacher, direct instruction, facilitator, coach, and there's a student in those three roles. And the coach observing is looking in and giving feedback, certainly to the teacher, but also looking at the student as input to the teacher.
Mm. Yes, it's very interesting. It's an interesting conversation when you're helping the person think deeper. And you're doing it in an empowering way, not a diminishing way. And
right.
And do you think it's better to do it with other teachers or to do it individually?
That's a great question. I'll give you a couple of thoughts on that. One of the big processes that we use in UBD workshops, and my favorite is a design workshop, ideally over 3 or 4 days, as you do your in-depth, where teachers actually are building a unit, learning UBD, but then getting feedback. We have a set of what we call design standards. Essentially, what are the success criteria for a UBD unit? And we do peer reviews where teachers will share their draft units with other people, usually from other subjects or grades. And we have a formal structured peer review feedback process. To your question, we have had quite a number of cases of people in tears when their unit is being reviewed by peers, because my experience is our profession tends to be pretty thin-skinned. Very often our work is not public. And when you're playing a unit and you're writing it down, it's your ego is on the line. That's a long way of saying what we found is when we're teaching people that peer review process, we start by doing it with a unit that Grant and I wrote or someone else wrote that nobody owns, which has some deliberate weaknesses. So we let people practice looking at a unit against our success criteria, how to give feedback, how to receive feedback. So that's kind of directly modeled. Then we invite people as volunteers who wants to have their unit reviewed. And they, in other words, they see others going through it. And if the protocol is done properly, people are giving helpful feedback and sensitive feedback, so people don't get angry or defensive, and then people are more open to it. So that's a long way of saying, I think there's value in modeling any kind of feedback process and doing it in the abstract, maybe role play, and then opening it up to volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it's one-on-one, you have a framework for that. People know what to expect.
Well, and it's especially probably difficult because you're doing things people haven't maybe done before. I mean, you're going to a level of planning at a certain depth that is new, because they've always been in a different space in terms of how they've done it. You're asking them to do a kind of thinking and creation that is outside their comfort zone.
That's right. And making it more public than is, at least in our design workshops, than is typically the norm.
Right.
But people, almost to a person, I'm sure there's some exceptions, but found it incredibly impactful. They really learn a lot, and it empowers them when they're planning by themselves to plan better. In other words, they really internalize the success criteria, if you will.
Yeah, that's great. Is there anything else you'd like to share? Something I haven't asked, something else you'd like to share that you think is important for people to know?
The only observation I would make, reflecting on a long career and UBD, you know, for operating for more than 26, 7 years now, is that I actually think UBD is a more impactful framework today than it was when it was first launched. And my reason for saying that is, as everyone knows, the world continues to change rapidly. New disruptive technologies emerge, unpredictable phenomena like coronavirus is the only predictability of our world. And therefore, the capacity of students to be able to navigate novelty, deal with the unexpected, transfer their learning to new things is, to me, ever more important. And UBD is a framework that builds that capacity.
Well, it certainly is. And 26 years is, you're getting on now. That's pretty good. You're having a pretty significant impact. And you last a quarter of a century. You're doing quite a bit. That's pretty powerful.
Yeah, and that's half of my career. I'm I've been 53 years in the profession, but half of it was UBD, and I'm still riding that train.
Well, I'm glad you're on the train. It's a profoundly positive force. Getting people to think really deeply about what they do, I think it's one of the most important things. So I'm so grateful, Jay. It's been such a good conversation. One of these days, you'll have to teach me how to play pickleball. I'm looking forward to that. So I have to get out there.
Well, I apply UBD to my pickleball learning. Well, it's a joy and a pleasure working with you. I so admire your work as well. And thanks for the opportunity to be on your wonderful podcast.
Well, thank you so much.